Imagine a justice system built on rigorous evidence, not gut instincts or educated guesses about what works and what doesn't. More people could access the civil justice they deserve. The criminal justice system could be smaller, more effective, and more humane. The Access to Justice Lab here at Harvard Law School is producing that needed evidence, and this podcast is about the challenge of transforming law into an evidence-based field. I'm your host, Jim Greiner, and this is Proof Over Precedent. Welcome, everyone. This is Jim Greiner. I'm the faculty director of the Access to Justice Lab, and with me this morning is Renee Dancer. Renee, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hello, I am Renee Dancer, a researcher at the Access to Justice Lab.
And Renee, we've been through this before in at least one of our other recordings, but for folks who have maybe haven't listened to that one, why don't you remind everyone, how did you come to join us at the lab? What was your prior history and maybe a fun fact about yourself?
Sure. So prior to the lab, I was a court administrator in Pennsylvania. I started in Pittsburgh and then moved to the Pocono Mountains. And then for a short period of time in between that role and this role, I was at the SRLN, the Self-Represented Litigation Network, for about a year. Sure. Oh, and a fun fact about me. So I will change it up since we've already recorded one. I really love to cook and try new things. And so just a few days ago, I tried to sous vide for the first time, which was very exciting.
Just to endear yourself to maybe half of our audience, but maybe enrage the other half, or at least part of it, do you prefer the Poconos Mountains or where you live currently in Virginia?
Oh, well, if I never see snow again in my life, I will be perfectly happy with that. So I prefer Virginia.
Got it. Super. And so today we're going to talk about a study that is in its final stages of the field operation, which is what we're calling online courts. And so why don't you give us the elevator pitch version of this study? What is the sort of 60-second version? What's the treatment contrast, and what are we hoping to find out from the study?
Yeah, so we want to know the effect of remote court appearances versus in-person court appearances. And in this study, specifically, we're looking at those effects on self-represented litigants in family law matters.
And what sorts of things are we hoping to measure? What are the effects on what?
We want to understand if participating in either one of these mediums makes a difference on time to disposition, durability of court orders, and failure to appear rates. So let me just give a little bit of an explanation. Family law matters are kind of tricky in this sense because they can go dormant and then reactivate, or they can last for extended periods of time, or they can be quick and then come back after many months. And that's really because families change, especially as children grow up, and family dynamics change as time passes in these cases. So, for time to disposition, we're looking at kind of that first, what you might refer to as a final order, but anyone who knows about family law cases will know final should be in quotes. We're wondering if participation in any one of these mediums makes a difference on that time. And then for durability of court orders, we're looking at the time between that disposition and a request to modify or enforce. And so for time to disposition, we're hoping to see shorter times. And we would think the medium, if one of those mediums produced shorter times, then maybe that would be the better medium for this type of case. For durability of court orders, we're hoping for longer times because we want families to have court orders that they feel invested sit in, they feel like they can comply with, they don't want to make changes to, especially very quickly. So we're looking to see if one of these mediums makes a difference in extending that period of time, so making a court order more durable. And then for failure to appear rates, there's lots of speculation about remote appearances, especially having benefits for failure to appear.
So Let's go back then, now that we've got the sort of quick version of the study, the elevator pitch version, let's go back and fill in some of the details. So I think there are probably two key big picture developments that lead to this study as it evolved. One is obviously changing technology and the availability of good video conferencing software that can work on, among other things, a smartphone in addition to a desktop computer or a laptop. But then the second was the pandemic, and which caused all sorts of things to happen. So I at least knew that there was video conferencing technology available, but considered it something, up until the pandemic, considered it something that I might use once in a while in a conference room that was specially equipped for it, until the pandemic hit. And all of a sudden I'm teaching classes, on my laptop computer, and it was a totally different experience. And now, of course, 75% of my meetings are done via video conference. So take us back. I mean, when did this study begin vis-a-vis, obviously, the development of the technology and then the pandemic? And what were the field partners that you were working with, what were they saying about the development of these two trends?
Yeah, we had the first meeting for this study in May of 2021. So we were still steeped in kind of closures related to the pandemic, but emerging from those closures. And so our field partners in this study are specifically the family court commissioners, but the family court generally in Utah's third judicial district, which is Salt Lake City. And they came to us because they wanted to know what to do while they were emerging from the pandemic, right?
Let's just pause there for a second. That isn't something we see a ton of in the legal system or in the legal profession, where the actors in it say, wait a minute, we actually crave guidance on some particular issue. So how did that happen?
I agree. That is I would say more often we have folks come to us that say, we have this really great thing. We want you to make sure it truly is really great. Right. But in this instance, they were, they're emerging from the pandemic related closures in the courthouse, where prior to the closures, they were conducting all hearings in person, as you may imagine. Right. There was really no choice for litigants. They had to come in person during the pandemic while the courts were closed. They were conducting all hearings remotely. Again, litigants had no choice. They had to participate remotely. And they now had, therefore, they had kind of the infrastructure for both. They could return back to everyone coming in person, or they could continue with proceedings remotely. There was some disagreement about what they should do among the bench and some of the leadership in the court. And they decided that they would try to resolve that disagreement through the creation of evidence around these two mediums. And our main point of contact to start the study was Nathaniel Player, who at the time was the Self-Help Center director and the law librarian at that courthouse. And Nathaniel, I knew from the SRLN, but he was also working with our colleague Matthew Steubenberg at the time on a different study. And so he was like, oh, can you do this study too? Because we have this, we would like to resolve this kind of disagreement about what to do by creating some evidence.
Terrific. Okay. And so they come to you and they say, how did that then get translated into, we're going to do this in certain types of family law matters?
It was the family law commissioners who really wanted to understand. That's who had the disagreement about how to return. So that's why we decided on family law cases, and they specifically were concerned about self-represented litigants. I mean, they were less concerned about litigants with private counsel because there just are more resources for folks with private counsel have more resources to expend, whether they need to come to court or participate remotely. They can do that.
Got it. So it wasn't as though somebody at kind of the, you know, the Supreme Court or the top of the judiciary is saying, we want to know the answer to this in-person versus remote appearance question. And we think it's especially important to know the answer in family law. It was instead that there was a disagreement among the people in power about how to proceed when they're reopening after the closures from the pandemic. Is that
accurate? Yeah, that's accurate. And I will say the state court administrator was also very supportive of doing the evaluation. He agreed to that they should do some evidence creation. He was aware and supportive of the evaluation.
And so conversations ensue, does the study, as it eventually came into the field, does it cover all types of family law matters or just certain types? And what are those types, if it's just certain types?
Yeah, that's a good question. It does not cover all types, and so it also depends on kind of how you categorize family law cases. There can be some differences of opinion on that. So to be clear, these are private family law actions. So that means that it's not child welfare. It is not juvenile justice. And then in the private law setting, those can be divorce cases, child custody cases, spousal support, child support, can be protection from abuse cases. For us, we focused exclusively on divorce and child custody. And we did that because those other ones can kind of fall under the umbrella of those divorce and child custody, but those were also the bulk of the kind of case types that this court was seeing, even though there are some others.
And by bulk, you mean most frequent. These are the most frequent case types. These are the ones that are occupying most of the docket. Yeah. And you use the term child welfare cases for the proof of a present audience. What kinds of cases are those?
Those are cases where the social services agency is in some way involved. So that a family has been reported to the social service agency for either allegations of abuse or neglect, and the social service agency has chosen to file a court action to resolve those issues.
True. And just pointing those out, because those are not included in this study. However, they are a focus of other research that you're spearheading. Does not this particular study. Terrific. Okay. And so basically then we're going to have litigation. Are these cases that we're going to, and we're going to randomize whether the case will feature an requirement that litigants appear in person, or requirement that litigants appear via video conferencing? Is that both sets of litigants? In other words, there's in some sense two parties. Sometimes they aren't called plaintiffs or defendants in this particular setting, but they might as well be. Sometimes they're called petitioners or respondents. But is it both parties that are going to appear remotely or appear in person, or is it one or the other, or how is it working?
It's both parties. So the court hears these cases on a specialized docket for self-represented litigants. And that's one of the kind of specific to family law efforts that this court had in place prior to the pandemic, and they had perpetuated throughout the pandemic. So they try to isolate self-represented litigant matters into a specialized docket for many reasons. And we can talk about those if you think that's important. But it's not an uncommon practice in courts to do that. For this study, folks who were randomly assigned to participate remotely would receive a court order scheduling their hearing, and it would give them a remote appearance scheduling order. For folks who were randomly assigned to appear in person, similarly, it would be scheduled by court order, and it would give them an in-person appearance scheduling order. And the court, to kind of operationalize that, were hearing these specialized dockets once a week. So what they did was schedule every other week to be in person, and then in the in-between weeks to be virtual, so that they could keep cases on track. But also they would not have like a mix of in-person and virtual on the same day. Now, as with any kind of process, you always have folks who make mistakes. So sometimes people would show up to the courthouse when they were supposed to participate remotely, they weren't turned away, right? And likewise, sometimes some people would show up online when they were supposed to participate in person, but they weren't turned away. But that was not a frequent occurrence. It just happens, right?
In some studies we do, we randomize in some way, or we intervene at a case initiation, or sometimes even prior to case initiation, where by case, I mean litigation, initiation of litigation. So the matter may have been, the problem may have been stewing for a while, but we intervene sometimes at litigation initiation. Was that always the case here, or were some of these cases, had some of these cases had some history before they were, in effect, entered into the study?
We did not begin the random assignment at case initiation simply because it was not really feasible to do that. Also because at case initiation for family law cases, you might have a filing, but you might not actually come to court for some time thereafter. So what we did was when a party asked for a judicial decision on something, which can happen kind of periodically throughout family law cases for small and large issues. When a party requested a judicial decision on something, they would, as a matter of course, be scheduled for one of these specialized docket days. That's where we intervened with the random assignment. When they had a judicial decision, a hearing that they would be scheduled for after the launch of the study and during the kind of period of enrollment. And then with some recognition that family law cases can last for a very long time or can go dormant and reactivate, we then looked at the entire case history from the beginning, from when someone enrolled, back all the way back to the beginning of their case, which, you know, in some instances we did have years, many years of case history prior to that. And then we followed their cases for 2 years thereafter just to see what continued with their case. But we knew, right, we knew that we might not see cases end. And we knew we might be getting cases that were starting at different time periods in their in the life of the case. And there was really not a way around that, considering how kind of flexible these cases are.
And this is one of the things that distinguishes, in particular, child custody matters from certain other types of civil litigation, is that they can go on for a very, very long time. And as you said, they can go dormant for a substantial period of time, and then they can become extremely active, go dormant again, et cetera, basically until the child at issue reaches maturity, reaches either 18 or another age, depending on what the type of issue is. So the idea then was, when there's a request for some sort of decision, that's basically that's when the case enters the study, and there's a randomization to either the in-person appearance condition or the video conferencing appearance. By the way, what kind of video conferencing software did the court use? Just out of curiosity.
Yes, the Utah judicial system uses WebEx. So it's one that isn't kind of ubiquitous at all.
not quite as common as Zoom or Teams, which I believe are the two that most people are familiar
exactly.
with.
Exactly. They used WebEx, and they had been, like, the entire state uses WebEx.
And were there instructions for litigants about how to download it? And I don't even actually know, because it appears on my WebEx appears on my computer, and then I promptly close it because everything that we do here is either Zoom or Teams. Is it free to use? What does the access look like for litigants?
It's just a hyperlink for litigants. So it might download a client onto their computers, but they can also just access it just like Zoom or Teams. There is just a web version of that. So that's what litigants would, they would click on a hyperlink. And those also were in the court orders, but also on the online docket schedule. They could look up their case and find the hyperlink there as well.
Got it.
And how did litigants, participants in the study, did they receive a paper order that would have the URL? Did they receive a text message? Did they receive an email? How did they receive notice of what of the standard information, which is you have a court date, you have a court appearance that you have to make on a certain date at a certain time. That's sort of standard. But then if they also had to appear remotely, then they would need information on what URL, because it looks from your description, they would need just a browser and an internet connection. Or if they needed to appear in person, they need an address. The latter, by the way, sounds trivial, except that we have run into at least one instance in our studies in which the court issued summonses, but neglected to include the address to which people were summoned. So I presume that was not a problem in this study. I'm very much hoping, put it that way. So tell me, what did the litigants see when they received these orders?
So they definitely all got a paper order, but I do believe, and I'm going from memory here, but I do believe that if they had registered their email with the court, they also could get notice by email, and they could sign up for that.
And then the link that they would use to log in if they're doing a remote appearance, is that to a link, sort of hearing room that's specific to their case? Or is that a general court appearance link that, the public could listen in on, for example? And if so, how was it managed so that the public wouldn't interrupt the proceeding by, for instance, forgetting to mute itself or something like that, whereas the litigants could speak?
Yeah, each courtroom had a unique link for that courtroom. So yes, and those were advertised to the public so that the public could view hearings, because as we know, hearings are open to the public. So they did, that was advertised to the public. The extent to which the public actually was choosing those, I couldn't speak to that. But the courtroom clerks, so there are clerks in every courtroom who are doing all the scheduling, among many other things, they managed all the WebEx participation. And so they would admit people to the room, they would mute and unmute them, as parties especially would, be unmuted the whole time, but the public would be muted.
Once a particular piece of litigation was randomized to either the remote condition, the video conferencing condition, or to the in-person condition, did it stay that way throughout its active phase, or were sometimes within the same matter people required to appear in person, and then at other times within that same piece of litigation, those litigants would have to appear remotely?
It stayed the same the whole time. There were a few cases where the judicial officer decided that it just wasn't an appropriate setting. Those cases were removed from the study because wouldn't be, they would just skew the results, I suppose. But that applied to maybe three cases. So the case remained as it was assigned, scheduled as it was assigned. So to be remote or to be in person, it continued on. And so anytime a subsequent request for judicial review came in, it would be scheduled in the same medium during that study follow-up period.
And so you mentioned, that happened in a small number of cases, mentioning three, and approximately how many pieces of litigation did this study randomize?
We have 680 study cases enrolled, and with varying degrees of complexity. If you think of interactions with the court as a measure of complexity, then we have, so the number of interactions is much larger than 680, but we have 680 study cases. Yeah.
And those are, that we said earlier, you said earlier, those include both child custody and divorce. What's roughly the breakdown of those two categories?
My guess is child custody is probably 2/3 of the caseload, and 1/3 would be divorce. Mm-hmm. And it's not uncommon for, even when a family knows divorce is coming, to start with a child custody case just to get to get that arrangement settled.
Got it. And that actually answered my next question, at least in part, which is that in certain states, including Pennsylvania, where you mentioned that you spent a fair amount of your life, certain types of family law matters can be split up into their own piece of litigation. So a divorce may be separate from a child custody matter, which itself may be separate from spousal support, which may be separate from child support. These could all be separate pieces of litigation. In certain instances, they can be combined, but there at least is the option to kind of go a la carte there. Was that also the case in Utah? It sounds like at least in part it was, if people could start with child custody issues before initiating divorce litigation.
Yeah, that was the case in Utah. And I think what some may think of as a best practice is to, you know, make sure that when those cases do start in an a la carte fashion, which is very common, that they remain with the same judicial officer so that you can combine them for you know, efficiency on both sides, both the parties and the judicial officer's case, to as new issues emerge.
And you mentioned the judicial officer, just for folks that are unfamiliar with this setting, are these cases exclusively judge decided? Are there juries in these cases? What's the setting?
There are not juries. There was a time where juries were a part of paternity cases, but that was many moons ago. That does not exist anymore. So these are judge decided bench trials, bench cases, right? In Utah, the cases start at the commissioner level, which is like a lower court judicial officer. It's not like a municipal court, but it's not a trial judge either. And the trial judge oversees the case. So in the event that a party disagrees with the commissioner's decision, their first opportunity to contest that is to go to the trial judge for what is called a de novo review, which means a fully second bite at the apple. You don't need to like reserve any particular issues for like you would for appeal at an appellate level.
De novo, Latin meaning, anew or without deference for legal significance, is it's without deference to what the commissioner has decided. The judge is supposed to at least take, in theory, take a fresh look. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yes. But by and large, these cases are decided at the commissioner level and ratified by the judicial officer who does, you know, review them, but to make them official court orders. But by and large, they're ratified there.
Super. Super. And so when did we randomize our first case in this study? When did the study enrollment kick off?
Yeah, we started enrollment in November of 2022. So you heard me say we had our first meeting about this study on May of 2021. And then November of the following year is when we had the first case enroll.
And that actually strikes me as a fairly rapid timeline for the way that these sorts of studies develop. I mean, we've talked earlier about ones that took 3 and 4 years to germinate. Would you agree this one sounds like it went a little faster than some previous ones?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
And so then how long did the enrollment or randomization period last?
We enrolled for one calendar year, and then we followed up for 2 years.
For 2 years. And where are we relative then to the process? It sounds like that this one, again, this one is in its latter stages. We're collecting data. Is that right?
We are collecting data. We're nearly done with our data collection period. So we will finish our final data collection at the beginning of August of this year. So end of June of this year. And we will finalize our data. Our final report is scheduled to go to our funding supporter by end of September of this year.
And so we'll be sure to do another podcast, another edition of Proof Over Precedent when we have some results. You mentioned the funding support. So this study wasn't free, it turns out.
No.
They aren't, alas. Field operations are complicated, fragile, long-running, and expensive, among other things. That's just the way it is. Who is the funder for this particular study?
The State Justice Institute is our funder for this. We're very, very fortunate to have them.
And so for folks who aren't familiar, what is the State Justice Institute?
Yeah, they are a funding organization, and I hope that I'm doing them justice as describing this, but they really primarily fund initiatives in state courts. They receive an appropriation from the federal government, and they're essentially serve as a pass-through entity for that work, but it does require kind of a competitive application process. And they set priorities every year with their board of directors, which kind of includes representation from courts as well as federal government officials. And they then fund research, they fund technical assistance. Their goal is to improve the state justice system.
And do we, in addition to our mostly quantitative focused research that's going on, is there other research that's going on simultaneously?
Yeah, we partnered with Emily LaGrada on this study, and Emily's work in this study, and I think by and large, is focused on procedural justice. And so Emily did a non-causal opt-in survey operation alongside this study to understand satisfaction with the medium in which people participated, and then to kind of gauge procedural justice tenets as a result of that satisfaction.
And has the LaGrada and Associates, Emily's shop, have they issued a report yet, or are they still doing data collection and doing data analysis as well?
They issued a report. Their survey operation was kind of a shorter timeline. Their results suggest, but again, not causal, that it might not be the medium that is the dictator of whether or not procedural justice has been achieved, but rather perhaps judicial demeanor, which can, span either medium.
Right. And tell me, unpackage that a little bit for me. You say judicial and media, demeanor. What does that mean?
Allowing people the opportunity to be heard in their case, making sure you're treating everyone with respect, giving people an opportunity to ask questions, providing guidance for the next steps in a way that folks can understand. I think all of that mattered in these cases, and matters in all cases, but in family law cases especially. I think it's particularly a tumultuous time for families, and so to the extent that any of those kind of soft skills can be highlighted by a judicial officer, that's probably better.
And when you say that's the thing that really matters, that is then a suggestion that it actually isn't whether you're in person or whether you're on remote appearing remotely, which would be a scientific finding itself. In other words, let me put this differently and in the form of a question. This study, were we sort of hoping, or were the actors involved hoping, that one would turn out to be superior to the other in terms of remote appearing virtually versus appearing in person, or was one interesting potential result that there might not be any difference at all?
Yeah, I think from our perspective, we thought that there probably wouldn't be a difference between the two mediums. Now, from our field partners' perspective, we came to this study because there was disagreement. So we definitely had folks in both camps, some that said, we absolutely believe that this study will find in-person participation to be superior and on the metrics that we discussed before. And similarly, folks that thought virtual appearance would be superior on those very same metrics. And I think we came to this study not knowing, but also suspecting that there might not be a difference. And I think we came to this study with that hypothesis because of some prior kind of research and scholarship we did about remote testimonial fact-finding, and the idea that judging credibility is not really affected by the medium when you look at kind of sociological research about that sort of about the idea of experts judging something either remotely or in person.
And actually, let's pause there for just a second. So judging credibility, in other words, the research that you mentioned, which has led to a published article that you and I co-authored. I actually remember when we published that one, I almost felt a little embarrassed that we were publishing an article on this point because it had been so thoroughly proven that that fact finders could not distinguish in a strong way whether witnesses were either intentionally lying or just mistaken in their testimony. And the literature trail on that was so long and in the sense of so many papers and decades long. In other words, this is something that psychologists and sociologists have known for such a long time that it felt a little silly publishing another article that said the same thing. The problem was that the myth will not die in the judiciary, especially and in the legal profession. But in addition, that myth was becoming increasingly relevant because it was one of the things that people were saying is why we can't go to virtual appearances. We can't use them because we need people in the same room in order to judge their credibility vis-a-vis affirmative intentional misstatements and mistakes. So we published that piece, and we'll include a link in the Proof Over Precedent blog and the podcast. But then that became part of the discussion that led to this study, is what you're saying as well. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I think that formed our, at the Access to Justice Lab, our hypothesis about the results of this, about what we expected the results to be, which was kind of down the middle when you think about what the expectations of the field partner was. They were kind of polarized. And ours were more down the middle, but maybe less palatable.
Right, for that reason. Yeah. And so if you think about it, then am I correct in saying then that once we get past the idea that the trier of fact, the judicial officer, doesn't have a it shouldn't matter, and the science suggests it doesn't matter to the trier of fact in terms of ascertaining truth, whether you're appearing in person or whether you're appearing remotely, then what the trier of fact has left to do in order to adjudicate the case is a combination of applying the law to the facts, which is not something that we hypothesize would matter or turn on the medium, and then also just doing administration work. When are we going to next meet? What's the next step? That sort of thing. Is there anything I'm missing about the nature of the task that the judicial officer has to execute?
No, I think that's right.
Mm-hmm. Thus our hypothesis that this would not matter. If it turns out that one medium is obviously superior to the other, then that would be an important finding that would suggest Access Justice Lab, your hypothesis was wrong, which certainly wouldn't be the first time that's happened. Won't be the last either. But if it turns out that there is no discernible difference between the two media, what would be the policy result? What would be the recommendation that would stem from that finding?
I think that if we come to that finding, I think it should change the way courts hear matters. And at this point, courts put all of the decision-making power on how a matter is heard, the medium in which a matter is heard, squarely with the judicial officer and what their preference will be. But if it doesn't actually matter for court outcomes, so you're not getting better time to disposition, you're not getting better durability of court orders, people are appearing at the same rates in these matters. So court outcomes aren't changing because of the medium. That means efficiency is not changing. So if we want to talk about efficient and effective courts, we're kind of baselined, regardless of the medium. Then maybe what courts should really be doing is changing that decision-making power to the litigant to decide what works better for them, and then maybe not dictating that appearance medium would, that actually perhaps could improve efficiency and effectiveness of these court orders. That's another study when you allow the litigant to make their own choice. But in these cases in particular, so if we're concerned about self-represented litigants and making sure that despite the less resources as a result of having no counsel, they can still participate and access the justice system. If we're concerned about that, and we're particularly concerned about this case type as a case type that includes kind of vulnerabilities in families, then the people with the most at stake are the people who are coming to the courthouse to request a judicial decision on something. And so maybe they should get to dictate how they access the courthouse, especially in this particular environment, because now we know we have the infrastructure to stand up both of these operations. And in fact, many courts are still standing up both of these operations. And so why make the choice? Like, why choose one or the other when you have that already available and accessible? Just let people choose, and don't force them into one medium, and don't force them to make a choice for the rest of their case either. Like, let them make that choice at any point in time.
Is there anything that we haven't gone over about this study that we should mention, or that we should have mentioned?
I don't think so. I wanted to make sure we talked about kind of litigant choice as being perhaps a result of this work, and also that we have this prior scholarship, lots of it, that would tell us that an expert, you know, decider does not necessarily have their ability to judge credibility or judge based on demeanor cues, either remote or in person, is really just random chance. And so maybe putting all our eggs in that basket is not the right decision.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, I think we characterized in the article we published, which, by the way, had no original research at all. It actually would have been embarrassing to reprove that the fact that the virtual versus the in-person appearance has no effect on judicial decision-making ability to discern mistake or lying. It would have been embarrassing to do another study because there have been so many that have said that. So we're just basically summarizing prior research at that point and comparing the belief to that it does make a difference to, you know, beliefs that the sun revolves around the earth, or that the, you know, that the earth is flat, because they have about the same amount of scientific validity to them. And then obviously your most important point is what you mentioned, the litigant choice, I think would be really, the really key message. If in fact the results turn out the way we hypothesize, again, they may not. And if they don't, then, you know, we'd be surprised, but not shocked. And of course we'll follow the evidence, where it leads. Renee, thank you so much. That's as always a pleasure, and I, as along with everyone else, will be looking forward to seeing what the final results are when they become available, hopefully at the end of this year. We hope to have some results that we can share this calendar year, and this is something that comes up a lot, so we're eager to share the results.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was wonderful.
Proof Over Precedent is a production of the Access to Justice Lab at Harvard Law School. Views expressed in student podcasts are not necessarily those of the A to J Lab. Thanks for listening. If we piqued your interest, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Even better, leave us a rating or share an episode with a friend or on social media. Here's a sneak preview of what we'll bring you next week.
The IRB itself is interesting because it is an autonomous decision-making body, in that if an IRB that is part of an institution, if an IRB disapproves a study, the institution cannot approve it. That's the final say. So it acts as a gatekeeper for these ethical principles.